Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome, Mike Colomeco here. This is Food Talk. Sorry we're a couple minutes late. L-train issues with New York, mass transit. Had a big lunch up at Columbus Circle. Hadn't been up there in years. Well, north of Columbus Circle at Lincoln. John Benno's great restaurant up there. And as always happens, I went there to eat just a little lunch. John sent out all this food. A one-hour lunch turned into 2.5. One train down to 14th Street. Then about a three-block walk to catch the L, which was 17 minutes late. Yes. Go New York. Anyway, so I'm going to skip my usual preamble because we chewed up time in transit and go to my first guest. We've got three guests today. We're going to talk a lot about meat, but sandwiched in the middle, I believe, depending on how I book this, is going to be Karen Page, who just has another book out, yet another tome that her and her husband put these out, I guess every couple of years, I write these great big books. And this one's called The Vegetarian Flavor Bible. So you can hear a lot about meat, and then a lot about vegetables, and then a lot about meat. My first guest is Craig Deal, who is a chef in Charleston, originally from Pennsylvania?
Yep, correct.
He's with Artisan Meat Share. So let's just jump in head first. Tell me about Artisan Meat Share.
Well, Artisan Meat Share started in 2009 at Cypress in Charleston, South Carolina. And we started out as a CSA-style program where we would offer a year-long membership for $250 to about 100 to 120 members. And they would pick up quarterly bags throughout the year of different cooked, cured, smoked meats in the form of charcuterie. And it came from bits and pieces of the local meats that we were working with in the area. And it was hugely successful. 5 years later, here we are, brick-and-mortar restaurant-slash-butcher-shop charcuterie shop. And it focuses on the meats that we're producing, the breads we produce at Cypress, and we also have the freshly butchered meats, charcuterie in the form of cooked, cured, smoked, dry-cured salamis and things of that nature. So it's kind of one catch-all.
Tell me about, so we're talking pigs only or beef and pig?
Beef and pigs.
Okay, talk about the importance of charcuterie, the sort of value-added aftermarket use of the parts of the carcass that normally in this country just don't make it. I mean, Americans eat the loin. That's sort of all we're interested in.
Originally, when we started the program, we wanted to find better pigs. And buying from local farms allowed us to be able to buy better pork. But we always ran into the issue of how do we utilize the entire animal without just making bacon and
ground meat.
Exactly. Yeah. So we started taking the hindquarters and producing salamis and dry curing the fat back for lardo and using that in our salamis as well and making head cheese and pork trotters. And we had trotter tots on our bar menu, which was pretty cool item. And then, you know, now having the sandwich shop, being able to, you know, not only pork, but also beef, be able to do things like, okay, hey, last week we made bacon, this week we're making pastrami pork belly and doing unique things with it. And taking, okay, we have an abundance of head cheese, but let's focus on making more items like ham and parsley terrine using the ham hocks cured out like ham and pulling it apart and doing this jellified terrine that's really, really absolutely luscious and but yet different than your head cheese.
And so the meat that you're using is for kind of free range?
Yeah, it's pasture-raised meat. We started 7 years ago, we started an all pasture-based pork system. I can't necessarily say the same thing about beef because beef raised on, you know, pasture that gets access to grains and corn really tastes so much better in my
excuse me, in everyone's opinion.
Good.
I mean, if I don't know a single chef walking around or gourmand with a palate that, given a choice, take the moral issue aside. I mean, you take a cow that's been grass-fed its whole life and at the end finish it with grain and corn to fatten it up and get some intermuscular marble, and you got a great-tasting steak. The ones that aren't, I mean, I know they're super healthy, and I know they've got loaded with omega-3s, but to me, it's like, boring. It's not where I go to meet.
Yeah, and you know, the added benefit to that is that we're also doing an in-house dry aging program, which we have the slaughterhouse. They dry age the carcass for 24 days, and then we bring in the middle meats and we dry age them for another 14 to 16 days before we start cutting the centers out. So your ribeyes, your porterhouses, your Kansas City strips, they all have this luscious, almost cheesy, beefy, you know, intense flavor. And we do it mainly for the enzymatic reaction where the meat eats more tender because, you know, on pasture, these animals are walking around. They're living a good life. And the meat may be a little bit more tough, but through the aging process, more bold, pronounced flavors, but yet giving a good tender, good chew.
Yeah, I, you know, as an older guy that's been in the industry since a long, long time, you know, I still, to my palate, the gold standard, and this is not something politically correct, but American prime commodity, 30-40 day dry age, that's just insane.
Yeah.
That funky nutty smell, you just can't replace it. I don't eat a lot of it. I mean, Citarella has a pretty good dry aging what am I trying to say? They do it in Citarella, New York, and some steakhouses. Keen's is one of my favorites, and of course Peter Luger's is all dry aging. That stuff's the gold standard. So where'd you learn charcuterie? Is really interesting because it's making a big comeback. That whole idea of what you're doing.
When
I was a chef coming up, a lot of French chefs did it. I learned from one of the great masters in New York, Christian Delouvrier. I would come to my day off, and Christian, in the beginning, would let me cube the meat, and then after a couple of weeks, he'd let me grind it, and then I could add this, and then finally, like after a couple of months of apprentice, it was okay. Here's how we do this: different grinds, studded, make a terrine, wrap it in fat, press it, and I was like thrilled. It was like suddenly I had this new toy, and then it kind of fell off. I didn't see programs on many menus, and then now it seems to be coming back. So talk about where you learned and, you know, the importance of this.
Well, I always tell people the way in which I learned was I bought a pig, you know, and it was a whole pig, and I had another whole pig coming in 2 weeks. So, you know, other than just selling pork chops and pork belly and roasted shoulders, I had to get creative with the heads, the trotters, the hindquarter, because hams don't grace a lot of fine dining menus unless you're going to do things like schnitzels and pounded cutlets and things of that nature. So we had to get creative at using the hams in some form of preservation method. And that came with, we've made some sausages and they've turned out pretty well. Let's see if we can hang them in this back room. And, you know, the first ones, they went in the trash can. They didn't turn out too well. But with every failure, as long as you are a dedicated chef, the utmost respect that you can give anything is to see it become the most successful that you possibly can. And that's what our quest was. If we're not just going to make it, we're going to make it better than what we can buy. And we're going to put our best foot forward and we're going to adapt to our environment and make it that much more than what it than what it could be. And it all stems with the quality of the pig first and foremost.
Yeah.
And we were able to get really good pasture pigs that were rooting in the dirt so that, you know, an animal that roots in the dirt has good, luscious, dirty, porky flavor.
It's unmistakable.
When you dry it out, that dirty, porky flavor comes out so much more. And especially in the fat. The better the quality of the fat, the better the quality of the charcuterie in the end. So we started doing pâtés, terrines, and some salamis. And then we're like, okay, let's hang a ham. And the hams take 2 to 3 years bone in.
Yeah.
So we adapted and we started taking the bones out. So it was a boneless prosciutto, almost done like a speck.
And I was about to say, so cured and lightly smoked. So it is
So some of them we do just cured.
Okay, which is like prosciutto.
And then some of them we do cured and smoked like speck. And the results were phenomenal. And we could get those done in 8 months to a year.
Right.
So by eliminating loss in forms of time wrapped up, it's all about business. How much can we devote to this program without losing extensive amounts of money? So, you know, the first year it was, sorry guys, but, you know, the costs are going to go up for a little bit. But in a year when the products are done, it's going to look like we're selling the entire pig every 2 weeks the way that
right.
we need to.
And
that's the cycle in which we've been on. And now that we've opened, you know, a charcuterie joint sandwich shop, the moving through of product, the thing that's beautiful there is that we're able to make some different types of deli meats and cook stuff and put it on sandwiches, capicolas and things of that nature, and put it on, you know, put it on really good bread that we're crafting as well, and get it out really quick. So moving the entire animal is happening at a much more fast rate.
Well, you've got a well-oiled engine. How many members do you have now?
We're actually, now that we've gone brick and mortar,
we're done doing
yeah. the bags, the CSA boxes.
You don't need them.
We don't need to. You can come in 7 days a week, Monday through Friday, 11 to 7, Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 7, and you can get any of the cooked, cured, smoked products, fresh meats, fresh butchered beef, dry aged meats, beef shanks. We did some pastrami'd pork shanks, and we did some corned beef shanks that are going in the case as well for, you know, like New England boiled dinner just got a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, it's, thank you. That's right, a hell of a lot better. So you're in Charleston proper?
I am, yes.
Talk about
Charleston.
The food scene there, because I have to confess, regrettably, I haven't been down to Charleston in my life. And I've met Sean Brock, and I know the players, and every time I travel, someone like you comes in here, and I'm just drooling, thinking how great to live in that town as a foodie and avail yourself of all of the culinary talent, all guys like you doing this great craft with meat, what Sean does with seeds and seed recovery and the local farmers around this. Talk about the Charleston food scene in a broader sense.
The Charleston food scene, I've been there for 19 years now. So from 95, back in the day, I started at Magnolia's. In 95, there was Magnolia's. There was 82 Queens, slightly north of Broad, Carolinas. Lewis is at the Charleston, Lewis's Charleston Grill at the Charleston Place Hotel. These were pre-era to, when Sean came back to Charleston at McCready's, Mike Latta at Fig and now The Ordinary, pre-Husk and things of those natures. But I've seen Charleston evolve food city to where, you know, it used to be like, everybody would have beef tenderloin on the menu, and then it slowly became, as local farmers became more and more prevalent in the outer-lying area, that you were able to get lots of local vegetables and local eggs, and then it started to become local pasture-raised chickens and local pork products and local beef, and people were selling to the back door. So the food scene evolved just as exponential as the new chef movement started to come into town, and that also came from, you know, all of these old school chefs, you know, like Donald Berrickman and Louis Osteen and Michael Kramer and Bob Carter, Bob Wagner. They all paved the way for this new avant-garde chef coming into Charleston and doing all of these great things. And, you know, when Mike Latta opened Fig Restaurant, it really revitalized the local food movement. And then Sean opened Husk and really put the hyper-local scene on Charleston, which was absolutely fabulous. I mean, without, you know, spearheading any one particular part, it's like you look at the Charleston food scene and
it's world-class.
We all play a different spectacular part at preserving what Charleston is all about.
Yeah, and then add in guys like the work that's being done at Anson Mills, and you suddenly have this, you know, this sort of low country revival where you have the ocean, so you've got great seafood, you've got a really long growing season because you're south of the Mid-Atlantic, so unlike, you know, us up here or me down in South Jersey even, which is pretty far south, I mean, you've got a great long season, early springs, relatively mild winters, one hopes, and just these great ingredients to play with.
Yeah, we get squash blossoms three times out of the year, you know, spring, summer, fall. Tomatoes grow up until, tomatoes are probably still growing right now in different areas in South Carolina. So yeah. The accessibility to great product is there. Does it take more work? Yes, it does. But is the quality there? Absolutely.
Yeah, but I think that's the biggest and most important movement forward in the American culinary scene in the last couple of decades, certainly from my generation to yours, is when I was a kid coming up, but we got, I mean, there was no local farm movement. There weren't local farms. It was like the big commodity stuff. Or if you were high-end, which is where all the restaurants I was, you were getting stuff from Europe once or twice a week, flown in from the Rangis market. But even then, it's like flown in from France. It's like, that's the best we could do. Mm-hmm. And now the ingredients available to chefs like you in this country are as good or better than anything any of the European chefs have to play with, period.
Absolutely.
Which just puts us world class.
And I say that about our charcuterie program. You know,
we could talk breads. We could talk cheese. We could talk you name it.
But in the forms of the heritage pigs in which we're able to get access to, these old line, rich, fatty, beautiful pigs, you know, if we don't use them, we lose them. So in the form of curing meat, these are pigs that need to be cured. And when you cure it and put it up next to some of the old school French and the old school Italian lines, it's like, why is that charcuterie so special? Because of the pig in which we have to work with. So if we can't compete in a global influence on the way in which we cure meat in the next 5 years, I'd be absolutely
I just
you know,
got back from a week in the Alto Adige. We were in Bolzano, and so every day was spec for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had some restaurants they make it in house, whole pig spec, mm-hmm. not just the leg. And so I came back, and I was a couple of weeks ago in the Heritage Meat Market, where I buy all of my organic meat in the Essex Street Market in Manhattan. You know, they have a ham counter that I never really go to because I don't eat a lot of ham. And she's the woman there, she's great. Emily said, why don't we do a little ham tasting just today? And she, the first one she sliced was a Benton boneless smoked ham. And I put it in my – I smelled it, put it in my mouth. And if my eyes were closed and I had to bet the ranch, spec. Mm-hmm. As good as the best spec I had. And I'm like, no shit. They've been doing this in America for years. Just old school, and now you've got...
Old school country store.
Yeah.
You know, this is like country living. This is how I grew up. And, you know,
so talk about where you grew up, because I'm originally from Philly. You're from Penn something?
Danville.
Danville.
Where's Danville? Which is Danville? 60 miles north of Harrisburg. Poof. Smallest county in the state of Pennsylvania.
Wow. That's the boonies, dude.
Montour County, You know, my grandfather had a 95-acre farm, had seven children, gave each of them a little bit of land. And, you know, growing up, me and my brother, we kind of helped out a little bit doing different odd and end projects. But, you know, I grew up seeing where really good food came from, and that meant going out to the garden and picking it. Yeah. You know, my other uncle had a butcher shop, and my dad would always take me in the back door and like, hey, come check this out. And it was not uncommon to see, like, a whole pig just getting hung up and pigs getting slaughtered, and it was just common practice. My father was also an avid hunter, fisherman, and we knew where our food came from, and we respected that. And, you know, kind of look back at it, and it's like, I can see why, you know, what other reason did I have to become a chef? Did a chef run in my family? No, but I knew what good food was. I appreciated good food, and I want to be able to carry on, you know, being able to get really good quality ingredients, putting time, the time and effort into making the product really, really shine for what it should be, and you know, putting smiles on people's faces.
Beautiful. Hey, Liz, is my next guest in, by the way? Okay, we have to break this off. Thanks so much for coming in. Last minute, sorry, it was like fumbling. We had an email thread that I lost for a week, and then all of a sudden I'm like, wait, and I'm famous for like people showing up in the studio, and I'm like, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
I'm booked today.
Yeah.
What are we going to do this? So, great to have met you.
Well,
have you enjoyed your time in Manhattan?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, any great meals?
Well, we had breakfast at the Breslin, and needed to walk around the block a couple times to work off all
day. Oh, dude, I had the lunch. This John wouldn't stop feeding me. He was just sending out courses that white truffles are in season. I didn't order this. Dude, come on, man. I got a dinner reservation tonight. I'm ready just to be right. I need somebody to go to wheelbarrow and dump me in the back of a cab. Thanks so much for coming. Shout out the name of your restaurants and the stores if they're different names.
We have Cypress Restaurant.
Restaurant.
And we also have Artisan Meat Share.
Great. In Charleston, folks, if you're listening anywhere and you want to have a foodie destination trip, of course, come to New York City. That's my backyard. But I'll tell you what.
Charleston's where it's at.
You can't really deny it. Craig Deal's been my guest. Stay with me. We'll be back with more of this nonsense in just a minute. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use. You know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of Ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, Mike Colomeco back here. You are listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The show's Food Talk, and my guest today, for the first time, right? No, you were out last year to talk about wine, right?
Absolutely.
Yes? No, maybe?
Out here? Yeah.
Yeah, here.
Absolutely.
It's Karen Page. Karen and her husband, Andrew Dornberg, have written a ton of books. I have lost count. Give me a number. It's over 10. Is it 12, 14?
It's roughly 10-ish. You know,
10-ish.
Do you
want to
count the second edition of Becoming a Chef? Do you count the Becoming a Chef journal? I don't know. I counted a half each. So around 10.
And they're big. When you guys write books, I mean, I have that wine book, What to Drink with What to Eat. I use it all the time, honestly. You reference it because it's easy to use. It goes by grape varietal halfway through the end, and then it goes by food. So it's like, okay, if you can't figure it out, look up asparagus or look up Gruner. You'll come together
exactly.
On the same page.
You'll find it.
You'll find out what to drink. But this one was a curveball. So I get this book, and I'm like, okay, cool. Because chefs love vegetables. And when I went to lose a lot of weight, I just switched to a diet that became much less protein-centric and much more vegetable-heavy. You know, a little bit of protein, 2, 3, 4 side dishes of vegetables. The weight flew off. I felt better, all that good stuff. So when did this happen? Did you get bumped on the head? Because you weren't. When did you start? You're a vegetarian.
Am I right? We've been eating vegetarian since May of 2012.
Well, that's new.
That's new.
Both of you.
Yeah.
So what,
this is news. This is breaking news on your show.
What brought this about? What was the epiphany? Mark Bittman came over and talked to you very slowly?
not quite. I mean, I'm the last person. I mean, your surprise does not surprise me because everybody's surprised when they hear Paige and Dornenberg went vegetarian. It's like, what? And how long is this going to last?
Agreed. That was my next question.
Yeah, no, exactly. In 2009, my dad passed away, and it was at the end of a tough decade for Andrew and me, and that we lost four close family members, both of his parents, and to cancer. And it was one of those decades, too, where we couldn't ignore anymore the headlines that were linking the overconsumption of animal protein with health and wellness. And so finally we started looking at it, and when even Michael Pollan himself is writing in An Omnivore's Dilemma that no nutritional experts agree on anything except the one thing is that a plant-based diet is best. So like you, we were inspired to go in that direction. We thought, we've never experimented with this in the very least. It's never held any appeal to us. I'm from the Midwest. I've been eating meat three times a day all my life. I thought, what the heck? Let me try to go vegetarian. So I thought it would last maybe a weekend or possibly a week. I didn't even think I could do it for a week. And what I found, much like you, if you're experimenting just reducing your meat consumption, I found that the weight flew off. I found that I felt better. My hair was moisturized. My skin was moisturized from the inside out. I had all kinds of energy. I felt better. I had more focus, more mental clarity. All of these things, you know, it could be an ad. And all these things started happening. I thought, my God. Could this be just due to this change in diet? And it was pretty extraordinary. Yeah. So I think from that, it got me very interested with people who have been doing that for this for many years. And is it a healthy way to live? And so I actually went back to school and earned my certificate in plant-based nutrition through the program that T. Colin Campbell, the author of the China Study, runs in conjunction with Cornell University. And that was also eye-opening. So it's been a real journey for both of us.
So how do you do grains? All whole?
Whole grains for
all
the most
grains,
part. Well,
right.
I just got back from 2 weeks on book tour. So
you have to fall off the wagon once in a while.
You got it. More white sugar and white flour than I've eaten.
But so
in
you were
years.
So you did the whole grain thing too, which is really part of that picture and really a smart idea. I mean,
absolutely.
I just love bread and I like pizza and every so often a bit, but there is no doubt about it that having those grains digested further down than your stomach, which is what whole grains do, is the way to absorb carbohydrate.
Yeah, no, so moving to whole grains, experimenting with many more whole grains, the farro is risotto, wheat berries is risotto, and so forth.
Forbidden rice, all those great rices they have now, wild rice.
All
of
it.
There's so many. I mean, my wife is kind of pre-diabetic, which we knew was going to happen because when she was pregnant, she got gestational diabetes, and that is usually a flag that down the line, at some age, you're going to start to, and sure enough, as her blood sugars began to spike, and I'm like, I'm not going to. I already make a different dinner for my kids usually because they're jerk-offs. Wow. So I'm not going to make three meals.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'm going to just do what you're doing. I'll just take the medicine. And then began to look into that whole world of whole grains and forget about it. There's so many options. I mean, yeah, I miss jasmine rice once in a while, and I still eat bread because I love so many good bakeries around. But, I mean, the whole grain thing is just, it's like you don't forget. Limited? No.
No, it really expands because I think when you're not having ground beef in the bottom of your taco, the question is, what do you put there instead? And so you can season legumes, you can season whole grains. You know, there's a lot of things that you can substitute. So what I found is that I really think about flavor in a whole new way since I'm not eating meat anymore. And I found that what I was really missing was really, in a lot of cases, the richness or the smokiness or the chewiness. And I found that there are analogs for all of that, not necessarily meat analogs as in
mushrooms.
I mean, there are whole foods that you will substitute. You know, you've got hen of the woods mushrooms, chicken of the woods mushrooms, lobster mushrooms,
they are
oyster
so
mushrooms.
Meat-like to
they're
me.
Incredible.
And they're great for you. I mean, they're just so bloody healthy.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you arrange the book. Because again, it's your guys are really smart at this. So, you know, I open the book up and I'm like, oh, no kidding. Alphabetical. And then the break.
But of course.
And then so it's alphabetical going by vegetable. But then talk about the descriptors because it's really smart.
Yeah, well, it's basically the book for if you landed from Mars on planet Earth and you didn't know what from A to Z what any of these ingredients were that you could cook with in a meatless diet, you could look up anything from achiote to zucchini blossoms and it would give you a description of, you know, how to pronounce it, what season it's in, what it tastes like, what the texture texture's like, how to cook it, and then a whole list of herbs, spices, and other seasonings that best enhance the flavor of those ingredients. So even if you don't have a cookbook that has a specific step-by-step recipe for whatever it is you're looking to cook, rye berries or lobster mushrooms, you can just look it up in the book, and it'll get you in the ballpark.
It'll tell you the flavor, the volume, the ratio of, in terms of grains, the ratio of water to solids, gluten, the nutritional profile, calories, time. I mean, it's like, it's kind of like one-stop shopping. I mean, it makes vegetable cooking really, really easy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why chefs have sworn by the Flavor Bible itself, which came out 6 years ago. For so many years, this is the book that they use when they're coming up with their restaurant menus, when the seasonal changes come around. What am I going to do next season? What am I going to do for this wedding I'm planning in 6 months? How am I going to design the menu? This is a great starting point just to spur creativity, just to get your ideas flowing.
Karen Page is my guest. The name of the book is?
The Vegetarian Flavor Bible.
Your husband did the photographs. Great job, Andrew. Love the photographs. Nice work. I'm just curious. Tell me about this. We'll talk about two things. But first, I'm from Philly, and I got out as soon as I could once I decided I wanted to cook for a living, because when I was growing up in Philly in the 60s and 70s, it was not a restaurant town. I mean, it was like Le Bec Fin, two other places, and Bookbinders. And
Susanna Fu.
Yeah, Susanna Fu. Exactly. Yes. And Italian places with check tablecloth. So CIA, New York City, end of story. But I was intrigued about this place, Veg. Talk to me
about
this.
Have you been
there yet? No, I haven't.
Oh, you've got to go. My gosh. This is the restaurant Veg, V-E-D-G-E, where Alan Richman, the multiple James Beard Award-winning restaurant critic from GQ magazine, had it blow his mind, since it's a vegan restaurant, although they don't call themselves that. They like to think of themselves as vegetable-focused. But they think, obviously, the V word can scare some people off, just the way the vegetarian word can scare some people off. But I think when you judge a restaurant based on flavor and nothing else, it stood up for Alan Richman. It stood up for us as one of the best new restaurants we tried of the year. And they just opened a new, more casual place this weekend. So they're really expanding.
They're
doing incredibly well, and really just helping to establish what you can do even without meat on the plate.
Yeah, I've always loved, in this city, I've always thought that Amanda Dirt Candy just nails it.
Amanda Cohen is brilliant. She is a brilliant cook.
Yeah.
She's fun. She's
smart, has great chops.
All of it. I mean, for her to do the broccoli dog, to smoke broccoli, to realize what do people love most about a hot dog? You love that smoky flavor. You love the fact it comes in a roll. You love the accoutrements you put on it, you know, whether it's a sauerkraut or anything else. You stick it all on there. It's great. Plus, you're getting broccoli, and you're getting all the nutrition of a broccoli. She does a portobello mushroom mousse that I don't crave, liver pate anymore.
No, she's
having
great.
It's richer. It's more flavorful.
Killer
it spreads.
Mushrooms.
The same way. It's fun, and it's proving what you can do with plant-based cuisine. And I think that's why the whole world is moving that direction.
Yeah.
Jill Robichon was quoted last week as saying that the food of the future for the next 10 years is vegetarian cuisine.
Salad at Bethany. I remember the first time I ever ate there.
I
remember it came, and I looked at the texture and the volume. He has a pile of
it.
And I'm like, what? And I'm starting to deconstruct it the way chefs would, and I'm putting like my little, what's on the bottom? What's this corner? What's this little droplet? And I'm like, what the F? This is.
I did the same thing. It was killer.
Right. Give me a magnifying glass.
Some
of these conversation stops.
Chewy. Some of them are crunchy. And then you get the creaminess of the yogurt, and you're getting the fluffiness of these sprouts. I don't even like sprouts.
Right.
Made me love sprouts. It's like, what did you do to these sprouts? It's like, well, it's not just alfalfa sprouts. Right. It's some of these sprouts, some of these. You get the complexity of flavor here. The freshness offsets this. It's like, holy mackerel. So good. Thank you very much, Bryce.
Yeah, Bryce is brilliant. We were shooting a show yesterday on Clinton Street, on the new scene of the newcomers. Unfortunately, we're losing Wiley, which is tragic, but New York real estate deals, man. I mean, the Four Seasons is going to go down one of these days, and that's been 50-some years in that building, and I know that Abby's...
Having less Union Square Cafe as
I know, Union Square Cafe. I mean, the point is that's the way it goes.
All these places.
But there's some cool new places, and one of them is this really great guy, Chaz, has great chops. He was on Top Chef like Leah was, worked in great kitchens, worked with George Perrier in Philadelphia at Bec Fin. They opened up this really casual spot called Seoul Chicken, S-E-O-U-L, like Seoul, Korea, where the whole menu is basically wings and sides, but he wanted to do something vegetarian, but he said, I'm not going to do vegetarian, it's like dye, I'm going to steam, this is a fried, it's going to go in the fryer, and he had this, the cauliflower, that he cooked the cauliflower, blanched it, and in that water it was turmeric and ginger and a couple other things, so it picks up the, and then he batters it and deep fries it, and I had all of his wings. One of my favorite thing was?
the cauliflower.
Honest to God. And yeah. he said, and he owns the place, he says, dude, same thing with me. And it's crazy. I mean, and he has wings with gochujang and wings with fish sauce and palm sugar. I mean, the wings are killer. Right. And then you get to this cauliflower and you're thinking, oh, really? I don't even want to go there. And love it first bite.
America is rediscovering its love for vegetables. Yeah. And I think as we're taking from this whole era that we've just come out of with molecular gastronomy, we've really discovered a whole new repertoire of techniques that we've been applying in the most cases to meat in terms of cuisine. But now that they're given the decline in meat consumption over the last 5 years in the United States, we're now falling in love with vegetables. We're treating vegetables the way we used to treat meat, whether deep frying it, spit roasting it the way you can get it at Narcisa, or whether you're confitting it, whether you're turning it into a Wellington, again, as Narcisa has on the menu with the carrots Wellington. It's really amazing that you're coaxing all of these flavors that you thought you had to have meat to get, but you can get them from smoked broccoli, as Amanda Cohen proved, or as all these other restaurants are proving. You can smoke grains, you can smoke legumes, and that's what we're craving, is those smoky flavors. It's not necessarily the meat. It, from my experience of the last 2.5 years of being shocked to discover that I'm not missing it, but I would miss the smoky flavors. I think I couldn't live without it.
It's a chef's dirty little secret, because you don't, when you eat out in America as a consumer, you don't see a lot of vegetables on the plate. There are a lot of work. There's not a lot of profit in them. You know, and chefs are like, people are paying for the protein. They're not paying for the side. So F.
And by the way, vegetables do have protein. And that was the other thing I point out.
You know
in
what
your
I
book.
Mean? You know what I mean? They're paying for the filet mignon.
People use the word protein, you know, it's synonymous with meat. And that's why everybody's been asking us for the last 2.5 years. It's the number one question. Right. How do you get your protein if you're not eating meat? It's like, vegetables have protein. Do you know how much protein broccoli and spinach have? It's ridiculous. Yeah. So actually, in the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, we have a macronutrient profile of every ingredient, which spells out the percentage protein, carbs, and fat, so that you realize all your vegetarian and vegan friends are getting plenty of protein.
Yeah, and that whole category of brassicas, all those bitter and those kale and cumin.
Exactly.
The dirty secret, chefs love cooking with vegetables. You may go talk to Marco Canora for hours about eggplant. You know, it's just like, talk about like a meat substitute. I mean, what can't you do with eggplant? It's like so bloody versatile. It's one of my favorite things to play with.
Texturally, too, it's so fun. You can do creamy, you can roast it and take
grilled,
all kinds
roasted,
of...
roasted, pan-fried, this, that. I mean, roasted whole, turn it into aubergine. I mean,
but I think the real reason that chefs are falling in love with vegetables is because they understand that that's really where the heart and soul of a dish's flavor profile lies, is in the vegetables, in the herbs, and in the spices. And whether there's meat in a dish or not doesn't really matter so much anymore. The way that we're cooking today, you know, even at 11 Madison Park, at Blue Hill, they're all talking about the fact that they're cooking with less than, let's say, more than 70 to 80% plant-based ingredients. So it's really, meat tends to be a much smaller part of those meals than they are in fine dining restaurants of years past. Back in your day, where you've cooked at all the finest restaurants in New York City, the world has really changed. It doesn't revolve around the stock or around the roast anymore. It's really around the vegetables, the herbs, and the spices.
It's a great way to go. I've been saying this ever since I did that, my own little Mike Colomeco's version of a weight loss program.
Just and you look great.
Eat
so
less
something's
protein,
working
eat less
for
protein,
you.
Triple up, double up the vegetables, fruits, go whole grain, and you're great, good to go. Thanks for coming, and congratulations on everything. That's great news. What percentage, on the way, what percentage, because you must know this, the numbers are all wrong that are out there in sort of public domain. What percentage of Americans now do you think are vegan, vegetarian?
Oh, I'll tell you exactly. The Gallup poll from 2012 said that it's about 2% vegan, rapidly growing, though, about 5% vegetarian, holding pretty strong, and rapidly growing segment of semi-vegetarian or flexitarian, people who are actively looking to reduce their meat consumption, 47%. So that's a majority of Americans, 54%, are looking to reduce or eliminate meat from their diets.
Me too. Get her book. The name is?
The Vegetarian Flavor Bible.
The author is Karen Page, and there's an I in that.
No I.
No I. P-A-G-E, like Page, like
P-A-G-E.
Books. No wonder you write books. Your name's Page.
I had no choice.
Andrew Dornberg is her husband. He did the photography. They've written a bunch of good books together. Just go to Amazon and buy everything with her name and her husband's name on them, and you'll be happy. Thanks so much for
coming
in.
Thanks for having me in today, Mike.
And we're going to have Mark Sarrazin come in right behind you. And we're not going to talk about vegetarianism much with Mark Sarrazin, unfortunately. But we're going to talk about beef. Thanks for coming in. Stay tuned to where you are. We're going to get music for a minute or two, and Mark Sarrazin and I will wax poetic about Wagyu meat. We'll be right back.
I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, Mike Colomeco here. You're back. You're listening to Food Talk. Mike Colomeco's version here on Heritage Radio Network. My guest is a longtime friend, and actually your father was too, and a great guy and did a lot of good work for me over the years. Mark Sarazan, that's spelled with a C, and anyone that lives in and around New York knows his company. It's DeBraga and Spittler. You see those big, beautiful trucks all over the city delivering meat to some of the best restaurants in the city. Has been second-generation business. Talk about, first, you moved to Jersey. I have not seen the new place. Used to live near my old apartment, and I remember the first time I met your dad, taking that subway and trying to find where that crazy address was, and then walking up those steps into that office, and you know, but your dad couldn't have been a kinder soul. Really helped.
Old history
helped a generation of us young guys before, you know, before computers, before Craigslist. When Mark Sarazan's dad was kind of like the go-to guy within the French mafia of chefs. He knew what kitchens were looking for whom. And you actually, he was like the godfather. If you wanted to move kitchens, you'd get permission from your chef. And more often times, your chef would say, go see Mark. Mark knows who's looking. And if Mark recommended you to Jacques Rachou or mentioned you to Fezeguet or any Sayak, you were in. So it was great. And he did that for me.
That's very kind.
So talk about your business. You moved to Jersey, and your the bulk of your business is, it has to be the Angus program.
Well, the certified Angus beef has been a big piece of our program.
And you do dry age prime.
Dry age prime. And really our focus, Michael, the last 5 years, but specifically the last 3 years, tying in with the move to the new facility in Jersey City was, you know, we've really jumped on board with sustainable agriculture and clean, naturally raised proteins, hormone-free, antibiotic-free, no animal byproducts. And we're now, God, I think 6 years ago it was probably 3 or 4% of our overall sales. It's now 55 to 60% of everything we sell is clean.
And chefs are asking for this.
Chefs are asking for it, yeah. Michael. And for us, it was a bit of a gamble. Even a year and a half ago, we stopped selling commodity pork and poultry completely. Not necessarily some provision items, but raw pork and raw chicken. Just said, you know, it doesn't make sense. There's the price spread from really good naturally raised proteins to the commodities so minimal. Why are we killing ourselves? So we made the jump, and we were a little concerned. At the time, it was about 17% of our sales, and I was like, gee, took a big gulp, you know, we're making a big stand, and yet we've grown double digits in growth the last 3 years in both categories, and chefs get it. It tastes better.
Congratulations. Thanks. And you do dry age prime, which is only a couple of houses that actually do that.
Yeah, we're dry aging right now. We went from a facility in the city where we were dry aging about 2,000 pieces of meat, and we're dry aging close to 4,500 pieces of meat right now, and the room is full, and we've had a lot of good commentaries and good success with chefs, and it's been great. And part of the reason that we get the commitment is because we're honorable about it. If a chef wants 20 pieces every week, he's getting it. I get a new guy, a new client who comes along and says, I need 100 strips. I'm sorry, I don't have them. And they say, well, why not? I say, well, because I'm committed to Michael. Right. Michael says he wants X amount per week. I've got to make sure that I cover his needs. I got to stick with the people who bring you to the dance, you know?
Yeah, well, that's your business. You also do retail.
We do.
You do mail order retail, so you're a great source of that because, I mean, I've had you on a couple times talk about this. I think that, you know, for those special occasion times of year, or if you're just rich, but I think for most of us, for special occasions, you know, if you don't live in and around New York, I can go to Butcher's and I can call Mark up and stop on the way home.
Right.
But if you're living in the middle of America and you're looking to buy prime, dry-aged meat, it's almost unavailable. And there's places that do it that are lying to do it. But what's your website? DeBraga?
It's DeBraga.com, DeBraga.com. And it's very much a pretty modern facility. It's like going to Amazon. You go in, you get your shopping cart, and you punch out, you put your credit card in. And some of the key differences for us is shipping. We ship fresh around the entire United States. So if you order something and it ships Tuesday, it arrives at your home Wednesday fresh. The biggest commentary I get from clients is, gee, the meat was defrosted when it got here. I don't understand. Is it still okay? I said, well, no, we shipped it fresh. It's completely fine. So it's been a big piece of our business, and it's a growing piece of business because, you know, we're very fortunate, Michael. We're in the Northeast. We're in New York, food capital. There's a lot of great food, much like there is in Chicago and San Francisco. But in New York, one of the big cities, we get whatever we want. And people in certain parts of the country don't always have that ability. Yeah. So if someone wants to eat what I would sell to Danielle or Jean-Georges or Tom Colicchio, boom, now they can get it in their home. And it's exactly the same
exactly.
product.
Same meat, same locker, same. Could be the same carcass. And I'll tell you, I mean, this isn't, and I hate to cast dispersion on my hometown, but there was a period back in the 90s when I was actually living in Philadelphia part-time when I had my restaurant in Cape May. And I remember I wanted prime dry-aged meat. And I thought, well, it's Philadelphia, fourth largest market in the country, tons yeah. of money, tons of educated people. And I began to call around, and guess what? None. There wasn't a single butcher store. I would have paid whatever, because it's expensive. There wasn't a single butcher store in Center City, in the suburbs, anywhere around there, that was had a prime dry-aged program. And I'm like, you're kidding me. No.
It's not surprising. I will tell you, since our move to Jersey, we're now in Philadelphia 3-4 days a week making deliveries, and there's the Philadelphia food scene, you know, it's, as you know,
yeah, it's come around.
It's cool. You go see guys like Mark Vetri, and you know, there's some great food in Philly. So there,
yeah, it's finally. It's great to see it because the town deserves it. It needs
really
it.
Good food. You know, there's Kevin's Braga. There's a bunch of guys doing really great, fun food there. So for sure, your hometown's making you proud.
Truth is, I've been living in New York longer than I ever lived in Philadelphia, so it is my hometown. But I think New York's my adopted hometown at some point. Talk also about, let's do Wagyu 101.
Okay.
Because one of the really rare things that you can get, and now we're talking about, you know, those of you out there that with the holidays coming up, with Christmas and New Year's and whatever, if you really want to pull out all the stops and buy what most people would say arguably is the best, most delicious, ridiculous, the foie gras of steaks, we're talking about Wagyu. But it was for 3 or 4 years impossible. Japan was not allowed to sell it in the States.
Correct.
That door was broken down a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that,
but talk about who
up.
You get specifically, because you're not just getting Japanese, because you're getting Miyazaki Prefecture. Talk about the Correct. Meat. Talk about the cattle and the program.
Okay, so Wagyu, as people know, is a breed of animal, much like Angus or Hereford. God's gift to the Wagyu breed is that they put on a lot of fat intramuscularly, and as they marble and as they're fed grain, they put on a lot of weight, and they marble incredibly well. That's just the gift to the breed. So we have product coming from 3 different countries, so it's a pretty extensive program for our company, and we do very well on the mail order as well. We're bringing product from Australia, which is a Wagyu Holstein cross, which is really what the Japanese favor. The Japanese market, because a lot of Australian Wagyu is shipped to Japan, they prefer the texture and the flavor component of the Holstein Wagyu cross. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. We deal with a company called Share Wagyu. There's a small family-owned business, and it's incredible protein. Then on the American side, we work with a company called Imperial Wagyu. And their program is an Angus Wagyu cross. So the Angus animal is a blockier, slightly larger, more American beefy type eating animal. So a little bit larger musculature. And again, beauty's in the eyes of the beholder. It's an incredible product. And then, of course, we do have the product coming in from Japan, from Miyazaki, from the Southern Islands in Japan. The prefecture where we get our product from, Miyazaki itself, has won the last 2 Japanese Culinary Olympics for the quality of their beef. So the key to all of this, of course, is the fat within the muscle and how it's graded. You know, the Japanese use a 0 to 12 marble score system. I know on our website right now we've got 9-plus Australian for sale, which is just ridiculous. But if you get – and you use the word, you know, you said foie gras. You use the right word, Michael. It's a foie gras-type eating experience. This is a very rich – rich beef. I could not sit there and eat 8 or 10 or 12 ounces of it.
No, you eat a 10-ounce steak. You could split between 3 people. It's just so filling. It's there's a great little restaurant down on down by me on Orchard called Sakemai, Sakmai. It's a Japanese centric sake bar with great food, and they've got a little bit of Wagyu on the menu there. Mm-hmm. And the chef cooks it really carefully, and you get just 3 or 4 strips, and you're loaded. Oh. And when you first look at this meat, when it first comes, and it comes in cryovac sealed in plastic cut in steaks, you don't know what you're looking at, because it's kind of pinkish white. It doesn't look like any steak either. There's so much intermuscular marble that the color of the steak is just hued to this like light pink, almost white color.
Yeah, it's much more of a fat experience than a protein experience, and that's why it ages so well,
right.
And why it cooks out so quickly. And you're going to cook it like a piece of foie gras.
Yeah,
you know, a hot pan. It's going to be a little seasoned. It's going to be a quick sear. and you're done. You know, yep. Some people reduce the pan with some vinegar or whatever they want after.
Let it compose a little bit, fleur de sel.
A little fleur de sel, and you're good to go.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty high in quality product. It really is. And Wagyu has really taken hold. You know, there's a different price for everything. We started our Wagyu program pretty extensively about 7-8 years ago, and it was kind of a struggle to get people up on board. Now it's taken off. I mean, people, you know, and chefs are learning how to work with it. It's the same old thing, you know, Michael. Chefs are always scared of the price of a product. Yeah. But when you show them what it costs per ounce, when you break it down on a plate, and they see that they can give their diners an incredible experience, it's a home run for the restaurant. It just really is. And even for the homeowner, and again, through our website, when we put this stuff on sale on the website, it's good. We have to take it off in a day and a half. It's gone.
Great.
So people do get it. So to your point, people do understand what it is.
We're talking to Mark Sarazan. He's the owner of DeBraga and Spittler, a New York, well, now New Jersey, but for many, many years in the Meatpacking District, a purveyor of meats and poultry to the best restaurants in the city. And now that same meat's available to you. It's D-E-B like boy, R-A-G-G-A, DeBraga. Google them, DeBraga.com. You can go to that website and see what they do. You did an event that I wasn't able to attend. You did it at the warehouse a couple of weeks ago. It was you took down a side of beef or something. Talk about what was it?
Because, you know, we always think we can do everything. We tried to jam in 4 different events in one day. We did what we call the Big Beef Breakdown. We had about 70 people in, a bunch of chefs, some press. It was really quite a day. We broke down a carcass. We had Dr. Schneller from the Culinary Institute come down and break down a whole carcass. And in our locker, in our aging room, we had chairs set up and a little mirror, and people were shivering. It was a guy in shorts in the front row. He wasn't too happy.
Where did you think this was going to be done?
Well, he wasn't thinking, but yeah. we had a really great day, and they enjoyed it. So people got to see where smaller cuts come from the shoulder cuts, from the round cuts. It's not always just about the rib, strip, and tenderloin. So we were able to try to explain some of that. Then I did a dry age seminar, tried to explain a dry aging program. That was all in the box. Then we went outside, and we had a chef from Connecticut working with our Japanese supplier. My partner, George Faison, and we actually broke down a Japanese ribeye and showed them the way the Japanese, with their knife skills, how they're able to portion it out. And we were able to show chefs what it actually cost per ounce. So they saw how affordable it was. And then we had a good friend, John Marcus, pretty legendary barbecue guy, come in with his big barbecue rib. And we did Nyman Prime short ribs in his traveling smoker. Yeah. They went on at 5:36 in the morning. By 12 o'clock, we're drinking Brooklyn beer and eating short ribs. So it was...
Maybe I should have gone.
I think you should. You know, in fairness, Michael, I was surprised you weren't there because you like a good meal. So
yeah, and I do have a car and a valid driver's license. So
not a lot of excuses, my friend. I'm sorry.
No. So talk a bit about a couple of... So, I mean... It's interesting because everybody at this point, I mean, if you have a pulse and you've been alive for a few minutes, we all know about the loin cuts. So there's the filet mignon, which is the tenderloin, the ribeye steak, the porterhouse. I mean, just as you work your way up and down that rib cage, the T-bone, the New York strip, the cantaloupe. What are some cuts that you're trying to get chefs to play with now that have been sort of underutilized? I mean, hanger steaks, I had them on the menu when I was at the Ritz-Carlton back in the 80s. I mean,
that's no longer underutilized.
Right,
people know
correct.
What a hanger steak
right.
is, for sure. Well, you know, there are things like the Terrace Major, which is a small, it looks like a little bit of a, looks like a small miniature tenderloin.
What do the French call it?
The French don't.
They don't cut it. Okay.
They don't cut it.
Okay.
We have
Where's it coming from?
It's coming from the shoulder. It's a small little piece, an extension off the scapula, and it looks like a little tenderloin. Then they have a cut we call the flat iron.
Yeah, I love that. You know what?
which is still an underutilized cut. The French call it a paleron. You know, when I was a kid growing up, my father made a pot-au-feu. That was a piece of beef that you potted. Now chefs are steaking it. They're filleting it.
There's a butcher shop in the village, Florence Meats.
Sure.
On Leroy, Jones or Leroy, one of those streets. And that's kind of where the Newport steak theoretically was invented, where he took a tri-tip, which is like a 4 or 5 pound roast, depending on the side of the carcass, and he cut it across the grain. And so I went to Florence Meat the other day because I love his meat, and I bought – and I know those Mexican kids are his butchers. They all know me. And I bought 3 or 4 tri-tips to take home, and they weren't expensive at all. Mm. And I have to tell you something. It's one of the tastiest pieces of meat on the animal.
Tri-tip, if you're on the West Coast, everybody knows what a tri-tip is. Tri-tip on the East Coast is kind of a foreign thing. We actually have a chef that I sent some to. We sent some Wagyu tri-tips. which so it's really marbled. The real key with the tri-tip is kind of triangular shaped.
Yeah.
It's really following the grain because the grain kind of runs two ways as you get to the point. So either you separate it and slice against the grain completely, or you start at the point. And then you do have to – it's just – you have to be aware of butchering. You know, butchering 101, slice against the grain in any cut, and you're going to be way ahead of the game. But that's a great cut. The flat iron cut into steaks is a great cut.
Yeah, it's, after the fillet, it's the most tender piece of meat on the animal.
100%.
And that little piece of whatever is in the middle. What is that stuff in the middle? That thing in the side of a flat iron, there's like
it's a nerve, it's a flat tissue, which
and that'll break down with braising. My grandmother used to put that in tomato sauce. It's like
if you braise that, you know, it gets gelatinous.
Yes,
it melts down. It's got kind of a collagen type qualities.
Yep.
You want to take the skin off the top and bottom. That's
right.
That's nerve tissue, but that nerve that center part, which we're taking out. I think it eats great, even with it, even if you slice against it.
Yeah, I've actually cooked, eaten them rare, medium rare, and it just gives you a little twirt of a bite, but it's nothing that you're going to spit out.
It'll have a little bit, you know, the flat iron can have a little bit of a little different kind of little irony, a little strong iron type of flavor, much like a hanger can. And, you know, I had a chef once tell me that you just a little bit of garlic kind of, you know, makes it work. And I'm not a chef. I've taken that to heart, and that always seemed to work well for me. But all those cuts it's terrific. You know, all braising cuts, we're in the winter months now. You know, chuck flaps are a great piece of meat. You know, people want short ribs all the time. Short ribs are expensive.
Yeah, they
but if you get the muscle that extends off of it, the chuck flap, which is the same part of the anatomical tissue of the animal, and you braise that, it's not going to be exactly like a short rib, but it's pretty darn good. And people are steaking that as well. So there's a lot of options.
And you must be excited to see how butchering as a career, butchery as a craft, has gone from almost extinction in this country. Once we went into IBP and boxed beef in the 60s and everything was done in Midwest and factories and shipped in cubed out containers and in cryovac, butcher shops closed one after another, and nobody wanted to do this because now it's your rock star.
Oh, listen, when my father came to this country, he was a butcher. He left school at 13. He wanted to be a butcher. When he came to this country, he was a butcher, but he didn't see a lot of future as being a butcher. Unless you were the chef of a restaurant, you were going nowhere. Now, you're right. Now, chefs were rock stars. Now, it's for a number of years, but butchers now people are realizing that the ability to break down an animal and maximize the yield out of it and put the lowest cost amount of protein on the plate, if you know how to really break it down, is terrific, to the point where my son's joined the company now. So we're third generation now.
Congratulations. Michael, I didn't know that. That's news. That's great.
He's been with me about a year.
That's so cool.
He's loving it. So it's, yes, I think it's great to see that people appreciate, A, how animals are raised, B, where they come from. People want to know where their food comes from, and they appreciate how it's handled and how it's butchered. So I think that's great for the industry as a whole. I really do.
Yeah, I see it. You see it in the city. You know, there's the when I used to live in the West Village, I used to shop at the Chelsea Market. It was nearby, and there's Jake Dixon has Dixon's Farm Stand in there.
Sure.
Where they
do a great job.
New York cattle, New York pigs, the lamb. They break them down in clear view of the public in the back in a little open room that's chilled. He could tell you the story about every animal they're cooking. They know every animal they're cutting. They know where it came from, what it ate, how big it was.
We're so stupid. We think we're farmers now. We're raising Dorset lambs upstate. We're raising Berkshire hogs. I've got Amish farmers finishing our products on apple pumice.
Mangalista pork you have?
Mangalista pork. Yeah. We're doing a dry cured still. So it's an exciting time to be back in the food business where people are appreciating what you do and are appreciating great protein. And I think most chefs appreciate when they have the option to use something really wonderful. And as a salesman, when I go to meet with a chef, if I'm talking to you, that I have something exciting to offer you that's a little bit different, that I know is going to make you look great, that's going to help your restaurant, that's going to drive your bottom line, that's going to further our partnership and our relationship, there's nothing better than that. It's a home run.
And the good news is, everybody listening out there that doesn't have a restaurant or isn't a chef, that same meat, that same meat locker, meat is available to you at debragga.com, DEBRAGGA. He doesn't pay me. I don't work for him. He doesn't advertise on this show. I just like guys that do good work, and I'm always trying to get people. You know, if you're listening to the show, you're a foodie. You're somewhere out there in America. You can buy this meat. It's not cheap. It's good stuff. Special occasion, great. I mean, I've said this for years. Eat less meat. Eat less protein, but eat great protein and eat more veggies. But I'm never giving up on meat, sorry.
You know what? I'm a big fan of eat a little bit less and eat better.
Yeah,
I think
that's
correct. That message should resonate, and I think most people do understand. If something tastes great, you don't need quite as much of it. If you're really satisfied with how wonderful the flavor is, I think you're okay. I would agree with you.
Well, we burned up an hour. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. I don't know who my guests are because I never have that part figured out. I mean, I know who they are. I have them booked already, but I'm not organized enough to give it a shout out. But you know, stay tuned. You can get the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at New York Food Lover and friend me on Facebook. And you could watch my show, Mike Colomeco's Real Food, on Create TV Coast to Coast or on the website of Channel 13 where it is streamed on demand, available anytime, anywhere, 24/7 on your handheld or your computer. Take care. See y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.